I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick,
Mersham,
Galen, Arlen, Bo, Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Sade 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallaxes listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be discussing the hot new book. It's been covered on MSNBC and by other media outlets, gaining praise in various media outlets and whatnot, entitled White Rural Rage: The Threat to American Democracy. And we're going to be taking a very critical view of this book from the perspective of an academic, Colby College's Nicholas F. Jacobs, co-author with Daniel M. Shea of The Rural Voter: The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America. Nicholas argues that Waldman and Schaller, the authors of White Rural Rage, misuse data for their thesis. Which, I mean, the thesis is right in the subtitle, The Threat to American Democracy. It's a book saying that white rural America is the problem facing America today. And Nicholas F. Jacobs says, that goes a step too far. And, more importantly, misuses data and survey research. So we'll be discussing that. Without any further ado, let's get right to it with Nicholas F. Jacobs. Welcome to Parallax Views. A guest that I'm really happy to be speaking with. Nicholas F. Jacobs is an assistant professor of government at Colby College and the co-author with Daniel M. Shea of The Rural Voter: The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America. And he caught my attention recently because there's a new book out that has been making the rounds. I've seen it covered on the news media, places like MSNBC. And it's a book about white rural rage. And Nicholas has written a critique of it in the Daily Yonder, entitled "New Book on Rural America Started with a False Conclusion, Then Looked for Evidence." So we're going to be talking about that piece. Nicholas, can you tell my listeners a little bit about this book by Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman, and what you think is important about pushing back on some of it?
I think white rural rage is representative of how many in the mainstream Democratic Party, Washington elites and leading intellectuals on the left and mainstream media, think about rural America, what they think rural Americans think, and why rural Americans vote the way they do. In some ways, the book is only surprising in its aggressiveness and tone towards dismissing and demeaning rural Americans as nothing more than racists, xenophobes, conspiracists, you name it, the label, whatever you have in your head, they threw down the gauntlet. But I think
I
it
was going
taps
to
into.
say that, not to interrupt you, but that becomes very much apparent with the subtitle of the book. I mean, that is a really provocative subtitle, The Threat to American Democracy, White Rural Rage, The Threat to America. I mean, it's really going out on a limb.
Yeah, and so it's not just an attempt to characterize or mischaracterize rural Americans, but to put, I think the entirety of the political problems that we are facing as a country at the feet of what is really a small and shrinking minority of the American population. That's what I think you need to know.
So it's interesting to me. One of the reasons I wanted to have you on is I think your piece, it wasn't it, your the piece you wrote wasn't polemical. I think you just went through the facts. And I know a lot of people are upset about this book for various reasons. I've seen some, I think, try to write more polemical arguments against it. What are your arguments against it? Because you really question the data, and I think you're one of a few scholars that has done that. I know that one of the scholars cited actually recently came out with a piece in Newsweek, Christine Lynch Trujillo, saying that she didn't really like the book either. But what are the data points that it gets wrong?
Yeah, and I do have another column out in Reason as of last Friday where I'm cited throughout the book as well, and I'm happy to elaborate on some of those disagreements too, where my scholarship on rural politics is cited in defense of this rage thesis, and whereas Chrissy is cited and says they just get it wrong, I do believe that my academic work was deliberately misread and misinterpreted for the sake of fitting into a narrative. So I am a scholar of rural politics. I'm an academic that usually does not get feisty and angry at work, except when I truly do believe it's damaging to the discourse in our country, which I believe this book is. Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman are not academics. That's fine. You're allowed to have opinions if you're not an egghead like me, right? Like we shouldn't always trust the academics, but they do present as experts on rural politics. In their presentation as experts on rural politics, they are quick to say repeatedly that you may not like the conclusions we reach about this threat to democracy, but we quote unquote bring the receipts. We cite over 36 studies and surveys and polls to support our conclusions about this threat to
They
American
make it
democracy.
sound very definitive. We've done the research. Yeah.
And when anybody tells you that they with that level of obnoxiousness that they've done the research, go and look at the research, which is what I did. And so one of the first things you'll see linked in the Daily Yonder piece is actually a line by line display of the sources that I pulled from their book with the actual research linked to it. Oftentimes links that were different from their own, but we can talk about that in a second. Hey, we got it from this study, but you actually didn't get it from that study, but I found where you got it anyway. Okay, that's fine. Everybody's allowed to make mistakes. But in doing research on rural populations, I think actually so much of my criticism boils down to something that scholars of rural politics know. Rural America is tiny. Rural America represents about 20% of the American population. It's about 40 million people, but in the grand scheme of America is a small fraction. Which more often than not means when you see a report out or a statistic on rural America, from a general, you know, from a poll, right? What did YouGov say about so-and-so? Or what's the horse race right now between Biden and Trump? What you're often seeing is an average that is taken from about 1,100 people. That you know, 1,100 people can get you a really good statistical picture of what Americans on average think. It usually means, though, that you've got between 100 and at most, but almost never, 200 rural people in that sample. And although you can report out a rural statistic, you ain't getting a good number on what rural Americans actually think. There's riffs off of that, but I think it all boils down to the fact that it's much more difficult than Schaller and Waldman admit to gather data, quantitative data, on the attitudes and beliefs of rural Americans than they would have you believe. And by going through, so I went personally through each and every source that they document and pointed out the flaws of that underlying research. You know, I say that, yeah, you brought the receipts, but most of them belong in the trash.
If you were to point out, what's the most egregious of those receipts that you think should be in the trash? Because I want you to give an idea to my listeners, maybe some specifics of what they get wrong.
Oh boy, it's fun to pick. It's tough to pick out my favorite. I actually, one is a good one because it's a poll that they use to identify xenophobia in rural America. Now, look, I'm actually not here to defend rural America. I'm not a sympathizer. I'm actually a resident of rural America, and I do wish more of my neighbors saw, right, that not only is immigration to this country a good thing economically, but like there are human beings with dignity that deserve to work and have chances just like you and I do too. Like, I think that's true. It's an interesting question, though, as to how many urban people think this and suburban think this. And Schaller and Waldman report out a statistic from a poll of Americans that show that overwhelmingly rural compared to urban are xenophobic because they report at higher rates than urban America that immigrants to this country threaten American culture. Statistically, if you look at the number of rural people in that poll, and the total number of people of that poll, rural Americans statistically do not think anything different than suburban Americans and are a point off the average. Now, you and I can have a problem with xenophobia, fear of immigration. You and I can have a reasonable debate about, you know, what we owe to people from other countries and how to balance those trade-offs economically in this country with increased immigration. But what they are doing is not that. What they are doing is that xenophobia is isolated in the countryside, and that's the threat. But the figure's bullshit.
I wanted to ask as well about, you know, one of the big claims they make in the book is that rural Americans are the most likely to take up arms against the government. And I think you look at that poll that they use by the Institute of Politics and say, well, there's a problem with that. And for people that may not be familiar with how polls can be misread, can you get into that a little bit?
Oh, that one. I mean, in some ways, that would have been the top contender, but it's debatable as to whether or not they even use the poll, right? So the Institute of Politics does two things, right? They do a very large scale statistical analysis of who is most likely to attend the January 6th demonstration or riot at the Capitol, which has become sort of, I think, understandably, right, the flashpoint for thinking about violence. And they report out on something like page 14 or 18, sort of early on in the report, though, that one of their findings is that rural counties are statistically and rather substantively less likely to send January 6th insurgents to the Capitol. So, you know, it's there actually written, called out in this report rather plainly. In my opinion, in all honesty, you know, the more rural your county gets, the less likely you are to be an insurgent. They then draw from a survey that they did a few months later, asking individuals whether or not they agree or disagree that it might be necessary to, quote, return Donald Trump to office through force, end quote. And they look at the percentage of rural Americans that agree with that, and they say it's about 27%. The error term on that gives you an estimate, if I recall correctly, between on rural America, but anywhere between 23%, right? So going down about 4 points to 31%. And Schaller and Waldman will say, well, look, 27% of rural Americans say we need to return Donald Trump through force. But if 20% of America is rural, that means they're sort of overrepresented on the forciness people. What they fail to acknowledge is the IOP's own conclusion from that statistic once they account for the error in their poll. And the thing that the IOP, can, the Institute, of, or this is Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism, through with the IOP as their pollster, tried to hammer home again and again and again through this report. The vast majority of Americans with violent tendencies live outside of rural America than within. And if you tr if you you're actually increasing the likelihood of violent demonstration if you try to pin it all on rural Americans. So the experts on violence are warning the authors of this book to not do what they're doing. I don't.
I also have to ask, what about, I know another thing people are latching on to when it comes to this book is rural white Americans believe in QAnon. Do you want to address that one?
Yeah, so I do, and I'm not the first one to point this out. I think I do put it in the context of rural America. So the Public Religion Research Institute always makes a splash with some brand new report. They were just out a few weeks ago with a big report on Christian nationalism. They got lots of money and routinely contract with Ipsos, which is a big international polling firm. A big international polling firm that doesn't know how to poll in rural America and actually overlooks a lot of that. So that and they're very guarded with their data, which isn't unusual, right? I'm not saying that they're bad apples or ill-willed. It's just tough to know, and because they never report, how representative a picture of rural America you get on any of these one reports. And all I can do is read what they tell me about who believes in QAnon and where they are. And again, it's almost the same exact fallacy as with the project on security and terrorism about violence. So they asked three questions, and I've had a lot of people point out to me that actually only one of those questions is really related to QAnon. The others are sort of related to the second coming is going to take place tomorrow sort of ideas. And that's why this report actually shows that black, actually, so two things. So there's a question about the measurement and then the representativity, and then a question about the margins. And rural Americans, even if it's slightly elevated, I mean, the margin is just so small. And then the average percent of Americans that actually believe in this stuff is so small, right? That here you are telling me this is the threat to American democracy, or are you really just trying to sell books? Let me elaborate real quick on the underlying methodology that I think is really relevant here on the QAnon one, right? So these same data points that show allegedly that rural American, go to rural America and they're all, I don't know what you do with QAnon, reading him, listening to him, watching him. Now read, right? Reading these conspiracies. That same survey reported in a book about white rural rage shows that if you are any other race or ethnicity than white, you are more likely to believe in QAnon, regardless of where you live. And that just is head-scratchingly weird. And I would ask questions about it. They seem more intent of just, oh, hey, we found our data point of the day, put it in the book, and add it to the fire.
I think there was also some surveys that they cite that actually say the opposite of what they are saying. So Could you talk about that? I was particularly interested in, there were a few, I think there was a 2018 report from the Pew Research Center that you talk about that, doesn't give nearly as dark a picture of rural America as the authors of this book, and yet they cite it anyways.
No, and one I actually haven't written about, but I'm happy to discuss, right? So this Pew study, which actually does have a very good sample. So in the entire book, I come to the conclusion that there are two surveys that are worth their while. One of them is a Washington Post KFF poll, though, that is problematic because it just doesn't interview enough urban people. So you can't get the, it's the reverse problem where usually rural is underrepresented here, urban's underrepresented, so you can't get it. But Pew does a very good job. They weight appropriately, right? Like it's an excellent study. And there are questions in there, and there are trends that we need to explore, we need to talk about. Again, I'm not letting anybody off of the hook. But unlike a research organization or an academic, right? So when I present my work, I present the totality of my findings. They go in and they cherry-pick from this Pew data that actually I think shows a number of important things that in a book where they make a lot of assumptions about the lack of shared values between whites and non-whites in rural America, this survey actually shows that a majority of Black Americans and a majority of Latino, excuse me, Black rural Americans and a majority of Latino rural Americans, quote, believe that they share the same values as others in rural America. So, this book is sort of predicated, it's actually a data point's never offered to justify it. This book is predicated on the idea that white ruralness is different from non-white ruralness. But in fact, this study gives you a data point to suggest that's not true, as well as a whole host of academic research, including my own, that they miscite. Other figures in this report show, that allegedly, right, on the racism in rural America, that a majority of rural Americans, and I downloaded the original data and can actually confirm that this is true among white rural Americans too. The majority of rural Americans say, yeah, white people have advantages in society. Just agree. They differ on how much. Some people say, yeah, they got a ton of advantages. Some people say, yeah, not much. But on average, right, the vast majority, like over 70% of rural Americans say, yes, whites have advantages over Black Americans. The majority say that women still face obstacles that men do not confront. They don't talk about sexism in rural America because actually it points vastly in a different direction than what many people might think. On hot button issues like abortion. So Pew, and so I've gotten some questions about this from readers. So Pew, by the way, asked this in two rounds. So you have to combine answers to the question. They first ask, hey, if you had to choose, should abortion be illegal or legal in most instances? And then they say, okay, if you said illegal in most instances, should it be legal always, or should there be times when, exceptions should be made, right? And right now, as a country, we're debating actually whether or not that's an actual policy. It would be important to know what people think. The majority of rural Americans think that there should be exemptions to abortion bans. They do not support outright abortion bans. I don't know. You'd think that'd be important.
Could you speak a little bit to the issue of, I mean, this is a, I think, a bigger issue that doesn't just affect, the discourse on this specific subject, but can you talk about the issue with the way surveys are cited in regards to sample size? Because I think sometimes people will look at the survey, but they won't look at who's being surveyed and the number of people being surveyed.
Yeah, and I'd actually say that first thing you said is the most important one, and the who is being surveyed, and it is the one in which, we actually get the least amount of information reported out on when a survey is published by a firm. And just like these authors have done, they try to hide behind the reputation of these outlets. But you know, people with good repute, like, this is a long-standing research outlet, that's fine. They still might not know how to do work in a community that they often don't work with, like a rural community, or targeting rural populations. So, sample sizes should be the more clearly identified part of a survey or a poll. Now, I will point out that nowhere in this book is there any attempt to tell you what every once I maybe with the KFF one they tell you how many people they polled, but oftentimes it can be very difficult, right? So they actually cite a few polls by well-known partisan outlets, so actually arms of the more or less arms of the Democratic Party. That have no sort of professional norms to report out how many people they surveyed, let alone how many rural people they surveyed. And if you look through this long list of sources, you'll see time and time again, I went digging deep that even I could not identify the actual number of rural residents they collected to get this quote unquote rural estimate. But even then, right, you have a question of how representative this segment of rural America is. Even if you get, let's say, 500 rural Americans, just how like the rest are they? And one of the things that's very difficult to do, although, in my work and my printed work that you can go find in my newest book, right, that I do. Is it's very difficult to get minority populations in rural America data on them because right they're a minority of a minority. About 80% of rural America is white. So consider, for instance, the American National Election Study, which is this highly reputable poll that academics routinely rely on. It's about 8,000 Americans the last go around. It only has 49 rural Black Americans for the whole country. You can't do anything with that. You can't actually tell me what non-whites in rural America think with that low of number, right? And that's in one of our best surveys. I've tried to, over the years, put my money where my mouth is and actually spend a lot of financial resources to get big enough samples in rural America so that I can get, 1,000 Black rural Americans and I can tell you what they think. And wouldn't you believe they actually have a lot more in common with their rural neighbors than Schaller and Waldman are trying to suggest they do.
It's interesting too, because do you think there's conclusions being jumped to in this book that, happen on the opposite end of things, where I think you mentioned Black Americans and the COVID vaccine and how people will say, the real threat to public health comes from Black Americans' refusal to take the vaccine. They are the least likely group to get it. And then you say, well, that claim's nonsense because unvaccinated Black Americans represent such a small percent of the unvaccinated population. So do you think there is like do you think this mirrors other types of I'll just put it bluntly, prejudices?
So I think we are, I say we, I think media, and I do think intellectuals are
Well,
quicker.
a lot of us, I mean, me at least, I grew up in like an urban area. So I think that can lead to issues where, I think in the city, some of us have, pretty bad assumptions about rural America. Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of people, I think because of that, because I think because of limited experience, I think because anecdotes are powerful. It is very people. Some people are very quick to not even check their reasoning when if that reasoning was applied to other groups that they know not to stereotype, that they are more familiar with, they would know falls flat, right? So this example about the vaccines is to point out that, like you can find a statistical pattern, a statistical difference, but you would not make that assumption you know, and why wouldn't you make that assumption? But you'll do the same thing when it comes to rural America. Quite frankly, I think a lot of it still has to do with a very deep-seated anger towards Donald Trump's election in 2016, and blaming rural America almost exclusively for that, even though the vast majority of Trump voters live outside of rural America. Again, it's only 20%. And you know, I get that. I'm not saying that rural America is a bastion of progressivism, and or that you're going to go out to the countryside, you know, find that, oh, I agree with this guy on 9 out of 10 policy issues. But what I am suggesting is that, you know, there is a narrative out there that profits off of sowing divisions between rural and urban America, and highlighting differences, but highlighting very specific differences. And one of the things that is easy to do when you do this is it's very easy to overlook the ways in which government institutions or elite institutions that are largely centered in urban America have benefited from the decline of rural economies, rural populations, and it you know, when you have a scapegoat, and you don't have to take account of those past actions.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I mean, I don't think this is the first book that maybe plays into stereotypes about rural and specifically white rural Americans. I mean, I think this has been part of the culture for a long time. You even see it in pop culture, right? Like with a movie like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, it's playing off that urban rural divide. Or with the old stereotype, I've always heard people say, oh yeah, isn't cow tipping a thing in rural America? And I'm like, no, that's a stereotype based on the idea that, oh, there's nothing that goes on in rural America. They don't have anything better to do. And that these are stereotypes that aren't as harmful as this book, but they are these stereotypes that have existed for a long time. What do you think the threat posed by these sort of stereotypes in books like Schaller and Waldman's book? Do you think they pose a threat to how we get through a lot of issues we're having today as a society?
Yeah, because on both sides, one, if you read this book and think it's telling you the truth, all right, th this is the land of the lost, of the irredeemable racist, the unconvinced Fox News watcher, right? And other than it being patently false, actually, we know that this has an effect throughout our political system, because look, and I think this is a part of a longer sort of push that these two authors have been trying to make in Democratic Party politics, which is don't even show up and compete in these places. You know, just cut your losses, don't even attempt to persuade. You know, we don't need to worry about keeping Montana's Senate seat anymore. And why would you, right? If this is the type of beliefs out there, like if I'm broadly sympathetic with the idea that if you think this is what rural people believe, you know, you're not going to want to support candidates for office that are going to have to sacrifice so much on not progressive values, just core American values, like liberal, tiny L liberal values, in order to win. Of course, it's not, which means that there's another threat on the side. And I will tell you that this is the threat that I see. You know, many of my neighbors ain't watching these two on MSNBC, but they have caught wind that, you know, Washington insiders are all abuzz about this book that explores the intricacies of the rural mind, and it's just wrong. And so here, you know, right, one of the divisions that does exist in this country is that rural people do feel, right, I think some of the reasons you mentioned, right, at worst, this is the hellhole of Chainsaw Massacre. At best, you know, this is the land of sort of stupid mayors and Schitt's Creek, right? Rural people do feel like they are routinely looked down upon and just not got, by elites and government officials. This confirms that belief. And it's going to push rural America further into, you know, the arms of somebody that isn't from rural America at all, but who says, hey, I'm willing to blow them up, you know, figuratively, excuse me, drain the swamp, you know, and validate your concerns. So if you actually care about democracy and fear about the rise of populism in the country, this book fans the flames.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, I mean, maybe the reason I'm interested in this issue that we're talking about is because I'm originally from Pennsylvania, and even though I grew up in Pittsburgh, I would spend time in rural areas, so I don't have the same views that are coming out of books like this, and I find it really damaging to, you know, reaching out to rural voters. And I also just think it creates this, like, I mean, what you're saying is books like this are creating resentment.
Yeah. And it's creating resentment throughout American politics. And I mean, it's become somewhat trite to point out the fact, you know, that cable news and talking heads is, you know, deleterious to the health and well-being of our democracy, right? Like, I was just, you know, in all honesty, like, I watched Jon Stewart, right? The Return of Jon Stewart. I'm reminded, like, of the awesome takedown. God, I think we're in the plural decades now of Tucker Carlson on Crossfire. Like, you guys are hurting our country. That's when Tucker still wore a bow tie. And, and you know, we know that. And yet we still indulge in this. And I guess what's really frustrating about this book is it's doing the exact same thing, but it's pretending to be fact-informed when the impulses undergirding it are nothing more than the same ones that drive, you know, the talking heads on cable news, the fighting between, you know, in order to drive ratings, the clickbait headlines. I mean, this book title in and of itself is a clickbait title. And again, I guess I got so incensed by the fact that they tried to pretend that this was backed by fact and rigorous scholarship that led me to write all the ways in which it was not.
There were just two more things I wanted to touch upon. You've mentioned that term elites a few times now. And I think that's an important term because I, you know, I have some background in sociology, so I'm a big fan of C. Wright Mills, you know, and the power elite theory. I noticed that term has sort of fallen out of favor now. In fact, I've seen people accuse anyone of using the term elite as using it as a dog whistle, like an anti-Semitic dog whistle. And I think there are people that do use elite as a dog whistle, but I think there's also, you know, actual elites in society, and it's a real phenomenon that does have to be talked about as a, you know, social issue. There's elites and non-elites, and there's divisions between them.
Yeah, well, I'll have to look into the dog whistle. That is troubling, and I'll have to be careful. I mean, I use it as an academic in which elites.
No, I know how you're using
masses are like common discourse in my work in studying American politics, American government. I'm not sure how one could deny elites, you know, and elites in many levels or in many different institutions, right? There are just a few publishing companies in this country that can push a book like this instantly into the hands of bookers on, you know, cable news that appears in everyone's country or in everybody's house in this country, right? That's just true, right? There's, you know, maybe six of them that are large enough to do that, that are elite institutions, right? That are not, you know, Columbia University Press like mine, which has like a publicist of one for, you know, the 1,000 books they write. Like, you know, There's an institutional advantage to, that you could think about elites in the publishing world. There's elite newspapers, right? What the New York Times prints is going to get a hell of a lot more traction than what the Daily Yonder prints. That means that the editor there has a whole lot more power over what you and I read than, the great editorial staff at the Yonder does. Higher education is by its sort of nature an elite institution, especially I work at a very elite institution where, we only accept 7% of the people that want to come here. And we all have are complicit in how in what type of politics we experience because we do drive it, right? Just as, the publishing company, I think it's Random House. I don't want to slander anybody. The publishing company of this book needs to understand the work that they have done or the damage they have done by letting this dominate our public conversation. So too do I say that elites in my world of higher education need to acknowledge how we've contributed to rural urban divides by standing idly by as rural young people become some of the least likely to drop out or attend college and the most likely to drop out. There are elites, and I think most people sense that in their head.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think people thinking otherwise is just it's kind of an out there thing to think otherwise. But if you have just a few more minutes, we've talked a lot about how Democrats view rural Americans, specifically white rural America. Do you think there's a problem at times with how Republicans may view rural America, or how, I mean, I know some Republicans that are not from rural America that claim to speak for rural America. Do you think there's a problem on that end as well?
So nobody that was trying to dethrone Trump in 2016, I mean, it was born without a silver spoon in your mouth. Now, again, there's a lot of people born in rural America with silver spoons in their mouths too, but I'm not I am not a partisan of either of these two camps. I think I'm highly critical of the left and Democrats because they're the only ones that seem to spout out this nonsense about the group of people that I study, which is rural Americans. But Republicans and the right do the same sort of thing when it comes to, groups that they're trying to stereotype, groups that are the other to their constituency. And I would level the same general abstract critique about, profiting off of this divide at the risk of damp, where the divides actually don't exist.
Well,
No, I
I
should.
was pointing more towards sometimes I think I've known Republicans that I think will speak for rural America as if they're the voice of it. And I'm not saying I'm like you, I'm not saying that there's super progressive people littered throughout all of rural America, but I have known progressives that come from rural America. It's I think rural America is a bit more diverse than both Republicans and Democrats like to admit, is what I'm getting at.
Oh, I really like that point. I like your phrasing of that. I think both sides actually commit the same falsehood in seeing it as a monolith. The Democratic Party and the left viewing it as, the homogeneous force of white rural rage. And the right viewing it as the land of quote unquote real America, where real patriots are. Funny thing about the real patriotism, for instance, is rural Americans are actually much more likely to be pacifists and sort of, pushed back against the sort of neoconservative nation building enterprises
Oh, really?
of the George W. Bush administration. Yeah. I mean, patriotism is found everywhere in this country, but actually we have evidence on those specific polls. Rural Americans are scratching their heads saying, what the hell are we doing? Where the rest of the Republican Party sort of marched in lockstep. Republicans have certainly overplayed their hand in thinking about rural America as the place that is locked in on some of these abortion Measures, right? But it would be a huge mistake to think about rural America as the place where this Alabama court ruling on IVF or, embryos, personhood is popular. That is not the case. One of my other favorites dealing with sort of a trope on the right and thinking about, like, oh, look how, oh, it's almost like saying, like, look how easy we have it in rural America. Rural Americans are some of the most hostile and oppositional to people to like mega church pastors, like
Wow.
to the politicization of religion. And think about where your mega churches are, like think about where those guys live and where you can actually get a mega church. It's not in the countryside, And so I think you're right that and that's ultimately, maybe there's a good way to sort of summarize my thought. Like that's actually why I care about getting it right. It's not because, you may think that because I'm a professor at a small liberal arts college, like I'm just desperately trying to help Democrats win a majority. Like I don't think Democrats have the key to rural America's success any more than Republicans do. But what is problematic is when you have Democrats write off this part of the country, it allows Republicans to take for granted the diversity and the issues and opinions that are in rural America.
I just wanted to ask you this real quickly. Two brief things here. So, in your experience, having researched this and looked at the, politics of the rural voter, what are their views on issues like government? Because I think there is this idea that if you're from rural America, you're just anti-government. So, what do rural Americans actually believe about governance?
I think you're very concerned about a certain type of government, and I'll be honest, it's a certain type of government that has been practiced in rural America for decades, which is, the federal government more or less governing on you and not with you. There is a much stronger history of local, federal and local state collaborative efforts in governance than in rural America. I think a lot of people in rural America have deep memories of when government showed up in the 50s and 60s and said, "Hey, we're here, extension agents, we're here. We know how to farm better. Here's how you farm better." And 20 years later, the family farm was done. Much more recently, many rural Americans remember government showing up and saying, "Hey, we're about to enter into this massive new experiment in globalization and world trade, and we're all going to benefit, right? Globalization and free trade is going to lift all boats." And 10 years later, the mill shut. So, there is a suspicion of government, especially government from outside, but that suspicion is built on promises that have been not only not kept, but just sort of seem like they were not given in good faith. Local government is strongly supported. This is where local schools are often the lifeblood of many rural communities. A desire to see government actually do more to take down powerful interests,
Yeah,
and
I
to
was interested in that because I think you mentioned Reason magazine, and I know they're more on the libertarian end of things. And I think sometimes I've often heard, people act like rural America is like the bastion of the libertarian dream. And I'm not sure if I would say all rural Americans or even most are necessarily super libertarian about everything.
No, I think socially, you're right. There's strands of it. I mean, rural America is different when it comes to guns, that's for sure. I think there are some differences with a general, what you might call social liberalism on some things, right? This isn't the land of Christian nationalism, right? There's still a strong sense of separation of church and state. But no, I by any stretch of the, I mean, like, just to put my cards on the table, right? Like, this is where I would disagree, I think, with a lot of my neighbors. I sort of actually have a much more willingness for government to come in and help solve problems. It's not a reflexive anti-government at all. It's an anti-specific type of government.
Very last thing here. I think one thing that I've heard when talking to people about this book is that there are rural Americans I know who feel like their problems or grievances are being ignored, and they're just being told, "Oh, this is just your white rural rage." Do you sympathize with that? And what are the problems that rural Americans face?
Oh, the problems are numerous, and the problems are very specific to different, you know, different communities that have undergone different types of transformations. You know, and to be honest, I think one thing that gets overlooked, you know, there's pockets of rural America that are actually on the up and up. You know, that progress, I don't, I'm not going to use that term, you know, this sort of economic, the increase in economic prospects in some rural areas is not felt equally, right? You know, when sort of ecotourism is boosted in one community, right, that benefits a certain member of that community more than other. But, you know, one of the things that I find particularly harmful is this idea that rural America is the Appalachia of J.D. Vance. You know, it's not. And one of the things that often surprises people the most is the fact that vast majority of rural Americans don't want to leave their place. You know, urban people want to get the hell out of Dodge, you know, statistically, but rural people, we like it just fine where we are, warts and all. You know, we worry, I think, you know, as a parent of two young boys living in rural America, right? You worry about, you know, they're not, what does it mean for them to stay here? Right? What does it mean? Like, I will very likely not live next to my boys growing up when they're older. But that's disheartening. I don't know what an economic model to provide the ample opportunity looks like for them. Right. I think, you know, I would point to a different set of solutions than others about, you know, making it possible for them to come and start businesses and to serve back to their community, to live, you know, healthy, productive, and economically prosperous lives in the countryside where there is opportunity. And, you know, some of that is being realized in this post-COVID world where, you know, the physical barriers of work have been reduced. You know, now I start thinking about, like, all right, how do I make sure that every child in my community gets that, and not just, in all honesty, the professor's kids? Like, where do we need to start addressing the years of underinvestment in our local public schools, particularly investment in trades, you know, and acknowledge that not only is it possible to live a beautiful life without having to go to college, right? Many people have no desire to, right? Like, there's dignity in other types of work. So I think this boils down to what we've been talking about this whole time, you know, empowering local people, or empowering people to speak about their own problems. And right now, books like this, our political system that seems to just, like, feed off of this, you know, it does the exact opposite. It's
Yeah, and
not a
to me, that's what I wanted to say at the end here is I do think books like this White Rural Rage book do a real disservice to our country and our politics, because I think we should be trying to bridge the so-called urban rural divide. I don't think people are that different. I think we all
Yeah.
bleed red, and I think this is actually promoting division rather than trying to work through differences and actually come to good, effective political solutions.
I think you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And, you know, it'd be one thing if the attitudes were there, right? like if the rage was there and you know they were all violent and ready to storm the hills or whatever, but it's not. And so by saying it is, you're exactly right. It does nothing but create this false impression that's so damaging.
Thank you again, Nicholas Jacobs, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners get a hold of your book?
So you can find it on popular internet sites, or you can support one of these non-elite publishing institutions and buy it directly from Columbia University Press, or encourage your local bookseller to go out and buy it too. But yeah, I appreciate it, the opportunity.
And just real briefly, what's the book about?
So the book does two things. One, it documents the historical rise of rural Republican partisanship and places it in long historical context. I mean, kind of with the troubling conclusion that actually what you see now is unprecedented and not like other rural urban divides that you may have heard about. And the second part of the book draws on a unique data set of over 10,000 survey interviews with rural voters to guess what? Actually answer the question, what do they think? Is it all just rage?
So folks, you heard it here. Pick up the book, The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America. It's probably a much better read than White Rural Rage. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. As always, if you appreciate the work here I do at Parallax Views, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So you know we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic community or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.